Okay, it's 9 o'clock. Let us begin. As always, I want to respond to a few emails and comments. I'm also going to try to show a clip, two short video clips relevant to what we discussed in the previous class, and we'll see whether that works. I'll leave that for last. First thing I want to mention, and by the way, for those who are new to the shows, I get lots of emails, but only when I think it's something that the rest of the class will find valuable. Look, everything you send is valuable, but we have it's time's an issue, so I think I have a pretty good sense of what will be of interest to others. I mentioned last class, the class before, we were talking about the Polyakov book, and he mentioned that in Lithuania no one wore their tzitzis out. And I could tell you other stories about that. Even in Rodin, the town of the Chafetz Chaim. So Dovi Hoffman, who I see is on here tonight, called my attention to something interesting. By the way, I have two Jay Kelman things, so my picture has become smaller. Maybe we can erase one of them so people could see my picture a little bigger, because I also want to show them something. The Mishnah Berurah says that if you cover your tzitzis up and you don't wear them out, it shows that you're embarrassed by them and that it's a terrible thing, etc., etc. And that's the basis for people today in yeshivas, they wear their tzitzis out. But Dovi calls my attention to what Rav Abadi, in his book, Or Yitzchak, writes, which makes a lot of sense, that what the Mishnah Berurah is speaking about, if you read the actual words of the Mishnah Berurah, this is what he's saying. He's referring to a time when people wore, you might see the Hasidim do it sometimes, they wear the tzitzis over their shirt. So when they wear the tzitzis over their shirt, if you're wearing it that way and then you cover it up, that shows you're embarrassed. But if you wear the tzitzis to begin with under your shirt, there's no inyan. There's no idea that you take the fringes out just to take the fringes out and show them. It's only when you have the garment outside that you're embarrassed by the fringes, you keep them in. So that's found right at the beginning of the Or Yitzchak. You can find this on HebrewBooks.org. One other point, a comment was made by one of our good commenters that the laws of Yerusha, of inheritance, are found in the Shulchan Aruch in Yoredeya, and that explains why, because it's a strange thing, why shouldn't I be able to give my property to, after I die, to whoever I want to? In my lifetime I can. What's this idea that after I'm dead, I also shouldn't have that right? Instead we have to do certain halachic ways to get around it, because the Torah tells us who gets which property. So the comment was made that, well, this is part of Yoredeya, and other things are part of Choshen Mishpat. Now, Choshen Mishpat, we really, the Torah doesn't insist on doing it one way. You follow whatever the communal practice is, the country's practice. Now, it's a nice comment. The only problem is that Hilchot Nachalot, the laws of inheritance, are found in Choshen Mishpat. So I just wanted to clarify that. One more point before I try the video. Actually, two more points. One of you asked me, I read the very first class or the second class about Avraham Yehoshua Heschel, the amazing story he told of growing up in Warsaw, and one of you wanted to know, well, what Hasidic dynasty he was, and would he have been Rebbe, because I actually said he was Kapitchinitz. It turns out, you can find all the information in this book by, it's called Avraham Joshua Heschel, by Kaplan and Dresner. Heschel was from an important Hasidic family. He had an older brother, but I think everyone agrees he would have taken over the Hasidic dynasty. It wasn't Kapitchinitz. Kapitchinitz was his first cousin. His sister married the Kapitchinitz already. The dynasty was known as Pelzoviza, if I'm pronouncing it right. That was his dynasty. One more thing. One of you asked me about Tachnun, because I said that I think that in the Spanish and Portuguese they don't say Tachnun on Thanksgiving. I have a long letter here from Rabbi Angel. I'm not going to read the whole letter, but he describes how they do not say Tachnun. They recite certain psalms, sort of like a Hallel without a bracha. So it's a very patriotic show. Okay, now I'm going to try, if I can, to show you two interesting videos. I believe I have the technology to do this. The first one relates to, we mentioned a couple times that the Hasidim don't necessarily feel bound by all the halachot. I tied this into soft antinomianism, an idea we'll get to in future classes. We spoke, for those who are new, we spoke about antinomianism. That, of course, is the Shabtai Tzvi heresy, the Christian heresy. But now we only have minor antinomianism, the times of davening and things like that. I'm going to show you a video now where a Rebbe, a well-known Rebbe, does the sort of thing that for a Lithuanian is would drive him crazy. I mean, we're so concerned with making interruptions and that sort of thing. What I show you now is also not an example. Some of you might think, well, he's old. No, he's been doing this from day one. And it's not OCD because he only does it on this bracha. And if you ask how the Hasidim know to make, say, Amen, I think the answer is they don't know, but after a while they just figure they need to say the Amen. So let me see if I can, this is the first video I want to show you, let me see if it'll work here. So I'm told we don't have sound. Okay, let me try to see here. I experimented on this and the sound was working when I tried it. Let me try something else here. Shalom, send me an email if I do get the sound. Now this is me talking. I try. Was that, could people hear that?
I don't think so, Mark.
You didn't think so? Okay, well then I'm going to have to experiment with this. I'm not sure exactly why it didn't work. We'll experiment for next time and I'll see if I can get it. When I tried it during the week, Shalom and me will experiment on it. It's not a spoof. It's the Tusha Rebbe from Montreal. I'm not sure why it didn't work. Hold on, let me just try one more thing here. And time, and if not, Shalom and Ami will figure it out. Okay, we're gonna. I'll stop it then. Okay, we will figure it out. I'll figure it out for next time. Why? I also want to show you something amazing relevant to Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan, who criticized the Ashkenazim for their superstition. And I'm going to show you something which I think at least most of the people listening to this show will themselves regard as superstitious, and that's a real exorcism. by a Sephardic Rav that took place in Jerusalem last week, and it was a very unusual exorcism because it was done over a computer. That is, the Kabbalist and his followers, about 10 of them, were not even in the same room. They were on the computer, and he tells the demon to get out and to exit through the toe of the person. So that I want to show you as well, just a few minutes. Okay. So let us, we'll do that next class, and show them if you can stay on afterwards with me. We'll try to get to the bottom of this. We ended last class. I just mentioned, we really took it to the end of a Rishon Moshe Chazan's life. I told you he died. He dies at age 54. We spoke about the very interesting case of the inheritance case. It turns out I misspoke. I said that the cousins were not in the Papal States. They were in the Papal States as well, which is why it was important to get this decision by the two Christian clergymen. The Papal States was the Pope's temporal rule. They actually are taken over by the Italian government in 1870, although the Pope only gives in and accepts the loss of his temporal rule in 1929, the signing of the Lateran Treaty. And in 1929, the Pope finally agrees, and I think it's a good step, that they will only have spiritual authority, no longer temporal authority. Today we're going to deal with the responsa and some other interesting things. The most famous responsa of the Rabbi Shlomo Moshe Chazan, the Krach Shel Romi, let me show you the book again, is the first responsum. Number one, I mentioned last class, and I repeat, those who can read Rabbinic Hebrew, you can see it in Hebrewbooks.org, it's worth reading the first one. And in this responsum, he permits, among other things, using church music in the davening. So how does he get to that? How does a posek, an important rabbi, come to permit using church music in the davening? Well, first of all, it means that we will use our words, but use their tune. In one place in this responsa, he even says that it's obligatory to do this. He uses the words of obligation, because we know from experience that this type of music, I don't know if he's referring to Gregorian chant or what exactly the form of music was in churches in the 19th century in Rome, but he says it brings people close to God, to love of God. He testifies that in Izmir, in Smyrna, the Chazanim, the famous Chazanim of Smyrna, would go into the church. They wouldn't go all the way. There were churches, in important churches in the Ottoman Empire, in Istanbul, and in Smyrna and other places. They would go, he says, like behind the partition, which means that they wouldn't go into the actual sanctuary, they would go out into the hallway right before you get into the sanctuary, and they would listen to the church music, and then they would adapt this music for use in the synagogue, the same sort of tunes. So this is an amazing testimony that, he's obviously one from the famous Chazan family to know this. He doesn't see the music as church music, as Christian music, but as music that raises the spirit. Christians happen to also use this. Music is one of the great chachmas. The Vilna Gaon is quoted as saying that the music is one of the great ideas of wisdom. You have these legends that the Gregorian chant is actually comes from the Levites singing, although he doesn't mention that. But he does say that the music used in the church, the tunes used in the church, cannot be made pasul, improper, simply because they're used in another religious service. Now, in general, Sephardic Chazanim knew Turkish music and used Turkish musical style in synagogue tunes. They used Turkish music, they used to recite piyutim, both in synagogue and at home, but this is more. This is going and talking about using actual church music. And if you look in the responsum of Rabbi Waldenberg, the Tzitz Eliezer, that I mentioned last class, he is outraged by this tshuva, and he simply cannot grasp how a Talmud Chacham, a sage in Israel, can say such a thing like this. And he quotes what Chazan says about how the Christians he lives among are decent people, and they respect the Jews, and he sees it as nothing less than kissing up to the Christians. Rav Avadia Yosef, however, has a much more tolerant view, because Chazan speaks about using just general music, love songs, and also church music. Rav Avadia has a problem with the church music, but not such a problem. I mean, this is found in his Yabia Omer, Volume 6. Volume 6, number 7. He discusses Chazan's view in great detail. And he says, what Chazan says about using the Christian church music, katsat kasha. He says, it's a little bit difficult, this practice that they would go and they would listen to the church music. But as for using love songs, Rav Avadia decides, halacha l'maisa, for practical halacha, there is no problem, nothing wrong with using the love songs. The non-Jews, the Muslims used to have love songs. Just take the tune and, put the Jewish words to it. We know that Rav Avadia, when he lived in Egypt himself, was very much into Arabic music. I don't know what that means today. That means we take any rock and roll song. Maybe we do that. I mean, some of the songs, Mordechai Ben David, one of his famous songs, Mashiach, his most famous songs. I think today most people know that, but certainly in the Hasidic world they don't. It comes from a non-Jewish world music festival winner, Genghis Khan. You can find it on the internet. But Rav Avadia says, I'll just read for you what he says in his the table of contents. About taking minaginot shashiri agavim, to take love songs and use it for the Kaddish or Kedusha and parts of davening. Mutar v'ein bazech shash klal. There is no problem whatsoever in taking the secular music, even the love songs. Then Rav Avadia explains, he goes off and says, but you don't want to repeat words. And I see that Chaim Lander says that the Mudna, Leon the Mudna, Yehuda Arye Mimunna, has a response on this. Yehuda Arye Mimunna also is the great permitter of repeating words in davening. Rav Avadia doesn't like that. But to use, just take any song you think of, any famous love song or secular song, and come up with a good davening, a good, put it in Kedusha, or anything else. I mean, there are Simon Garfunkel songs and Beach Boys songs that are sung to Zmiros and Shabbos, but I haven't yet heard them in Kedusha. And that's the novelty, I guess, of Yisrael Moshe Chazan. As I said, he goes even further. Chazan goes on and speaks about a lot of insight into how people's music, the music they are attracted to, is based on where they live, the general society. And it's no accident that the Sephardic tunes for davening sound a lot like Arabic tunes and Ashkenazic tunes, and Nigunim and the Hasidic Nigunim sound a lot like Russian songs and the like. That's only natural, and it's part of your culture, the beat, the sound. It's almost impossible for people of my generation to like rap or anything like that, or even like music from other cultures. He even says that some people claim that the tune for L'Davi Baruch Hashem Tzuri, which is Psalm 144, goes all the way back to King David. And one of the proofs is that Jews all over the world sing it in the same tune. He discusses this as part of his discussion about the value and the significance of music. He would have loved to quote the Vilna Gaon about music being one of the great chachmas of the world, but he apparently didn't know that. Now, Chazan, as we saw, traveled the entire world. So I believe when he says that this tune was sung all over the world, although I can say that with one exception, I have never heard this Psalm 144 sung. And the one time I heard it sung, the person said, this is the classic tune. It's in the Siddur to be recited before Ma'ariv, Motzei Shabbos, but I don't know any shuls that recite it. The one place I heard it, it's an individual who recites it. He's like a gabbai, so he recites it. But I don't know of any place where it's actually recited. We have lots of things in the Siddur that aren't recited. In fact, I was in Baltimore two Shabbos ago at the largest Orthodox shul in the country, which is Beth Tefillah. 1,400 families, bigger than the shul in the Young Israel of Woodmere, bigger than the shul in Memphis. And they actually recited after Mincha and Shabbos, Baruch Hinafshi. I don't know. I know there's more shuls than that recited, but I have not been in a shul that recited Baruch Hinafshi after Mincha in a long time. So they sing it every week at RJC. Very nice. I see something's being uploaded. If that's the original file I wanted, we'll watch that, and then I'll send Shalom something else, and he can upload it as well. But we'll wait for that. Chazan makes an important point, because I said that Rav Avadia says that we can use love songs, but we can't use... we'll stop and listen to this. See if you can get it going, Shalom.
The reason it didn't work is because people had their talk on. If everyone turns the talk off, and then you can do it. Try it again.
I've taken microphone rights away from everybody to play this, now I'll do it again.
Thank you. I forgot I had my thing off. Shalom's going to try to also upload the other thing I sent him, and we could actually see the exorcism. Now, this is not a stutter. This is, and it's not OCD. He only does it for this bracha, and he's been doing it since he's young. It's a Hasidic, it's not a Hasidic thing. It's a Tush thing. For whatever, I don't know what Kavanos he has on that bracha. There's a hefsek. No question about it. There's a hefsek from the end of the bracha to you eat. He repeats Hashem's name. But he's a Hasidic Rebbe, so he can do that sort of thing. Let's continue, and I'll see when... it might not be technically a hefsek because... Well, I don't know. It might not be technically a hefsek with the at the end. It's the same idea, but certainly you can't repeat Hashem's name twice. He repeats Hashem's name twice. I don't know. It's definitely not something that you'd find a Lithuanian Rav doing. Shalom, I sent you up above. If you look, I'll send it to you again. Hold on a second, everyone. I gotta send Shalom something. Let us continue. I mentioned that Rav Avadia sees it okay to use love songs to make davening tunes out of, but not Christian music. Chazan sees just the opposite. He establishes how it's obvious, based upon the early sources, that you can take love songs and secular music and turn them into use them for davening. So Kai Vachomer, if you can take love songs and you can do this, you can certainly take songs that are designed to worship God for a holy purpose and use them in our shuls. some of you might not like that, then Rav Avadya doesn't like that logic, because according to Chazan, Christian music, which is directed towards God, stands above love songs. Others might say, on the contrary, it's attached to foreign worship, Avodah Zarah, and therefore it's even worse. But that's not what Chazan thinks. Now, don't think that frumkeit is a new thing. Let me tell you what Rav Yisrael Moshe Chazan speaks about. And let me also explain the word frumkeit. Today in America, we think of frumkeit as a positive thing. But in Lithuania, there was an expression that a galach is frum. A priest, a Christian priest, is frum. A Jew is erlich. A Jew, I don't know how you translate erlich. A mensch, a good person. In Lithuania, when you use the word frum, or frumkeit, it actually was a put-down, a negative thing, someone who wore their piety on their sleeve. That's, if you recall, the making of a gadol, the book, the passage that got the book banned was that it had Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, or the Arab Sabatka, telling Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer that let me tell the whole story. According to the way Kamenetsky tells it, he doesn't tell us where he gets his story from. When Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer's daughter was engaged to Rav Aaron Cutler sent her letters. And if you read the book, there's no question that it seemed that these were love letters. Now he denies it, but anyone who read the book, that's the impression they got. And Rav Isser Zalman was upset with this. I don't see what to be upset. I think it's, you know, I mean, we saw the Nazir, how devoted he was to his fiance. But in any event, Rav Isser Zalman was upset that this is the sort of chassan he has, is sending his daughter the letters. Because if they're not love letters, why would he get upset? So he speaks to the Altar of Sobotka, and the Altar says about Rav Aaron Cutler, not to fear Rav Isser Zalman, in the future we will all suffer because of his frumkeit. Now, you have to understand, that's a negative comment about Rav Aaron Cutler, so I fully understand why the family was very upset with that. They're saying, basically, that Rav Aaron Cutler is going to become a fanatic, and we're going to suffer because of his frumkeit. So when I use the word frumkeit, I'm using it in that term. What do I mean when I say that frumkeit is not something new? You even had it in Italy? Because Chazan speaks about how there were some people, when they were at a wedding, if someone starts singing a song in the vernacular, let's say in Italian, they protested, even if the content of the song was proper. They thought that it was improper for religious Jews to sing any songs unless they were in Hebrew, unless they were in Lashon HaKodesh. And Chazan explains how this is crazy. This is foolish. If it's not the language that's important. You could have improper songs in Hebrew also. It's the content that's important. And if a song is in the vernacular, but it expresses good ideas, of course you should be able to sing it at a wedding, at the Shabbos table, anytime you want to. Okay, I get news from Shalom privately here that the exorcism video, it's hard to get it processed while we're talking, but it'll be ready next class to show you when we begin. Now, as I said, this response of number one is incredible. If you have the time to print it out, to read it on Shabbos, if you're only going to read one thing by Chazan, read this. It's not even a response about music. The issue, he gets into the issue of music, as we say, Derech Agav. The issue was not music. He was responding to a problem. The synagogue in Rome, the problem was they were not davening at the proper time. The shamashim, the shamases, the guys whose jobs it were to get people into shul in time, to start the davening on time, they weren't doing their job properly, and they complained that it wasn't their fault. They couldn't keep track of the time. And therefore, they wanted to put a clock in the synagogue courtyard. They did, you know, in other words, they wanted to start davening at 7 o'clock. They would be starting at 7:10. They didn't know what time it was. Not like everyone had watches or anything like that. The only way they would know the proper time to start the davening is if the clock was. So what could be a problem with a clock? Well, then Chazan was asked. By the way, this is also a clock similar to the Christian clocks. If you've been to Europe, you've seen them, where it would make a sound on the hour. That way people would know when the time of davening was. But is this permissible? Chazan's concern is not with Chadash Asr Min HaTorah, that this is something new and therefore it's forbidden. We have lots of questions like that in the response literature, but not Chazan. I'll give you one example. The Chafetz Chaim, in his shul in Radin, they didn't put in heat. And it's very cold in the winter in Poland, but that was because they didn't want to do anything new. They've always davened without heat in there. And when I say heat, I mean a furnace, not the heat like we think of heat, like some sort of place of, well, where they would burn wood to keep people warm. They didn't have it, and therefore they weren't going to start it. His son, the Chafetz Chaim's son, mentioned this in his biography. No, that's not what the Chazan was concerned with. His concern, or he was asked about it, was could they put up a clock, or perhaps this is Chukot HaGoyim, imitation of the non-Jewish practices, because churches had clocks on them. So this leads him into a complete and detailed discussion of the parameters of borrowing non-Jewish practices or doing things that the Gentiles do, Chukot HaGoyim. Not surprisingly, he concludes that there's no problem using the clock. The standard view is that there is no problem taking something, even if it begins with the Gentiles, as long as it has no connection to immorality, sexual immorality, or idolatry. The Vilna Gaon has a different opinion. He thinks that anything that on our own we wouldn't have come up with, we can't take from the non-Jews, but that's not the standard view. The standard view of the Ran and the Marik and the Shulchan Aruch is that there's no problem. If the non-Jews have a good idea, fine, we can use that as well. Fa'ur, of course, I mentioned Fa'ur, his book on Chazan. He discusses this response and discusses all the important responsa, and he shows that Chazan is not just operating as a posseg, as a halachist. Chazan has references throughout his writings to people like Voltaire and Diderot. He is fully at home with the secular literature, with the new philosophies, and he recognizes the great dangers that philosophies such as by Voltaire. Voltaire, we think of Voltaire as being a great enemy and presenting a great threat to Christianity, to Catholicism in particular. But he was also an enemy to Judaism, because any philosophy that is in opposition to revealed religion is going to be problematic. What does Chazan say then? He doesn't say to ignore this. He urges the rabbis to turn to the tradition of Jewish philosophy and to teach this to the young. In other words, to respond to the current intellectual trends. Not to create a ghetto, which in any event would have been impossible, but to turn to the tradition of Jewish philosophy, which in the Sephardic world had always been a living tradition, and now we can use it. We can maybe he's overconfident in thinking that Maimonides and Rav Gaon and the rest could find the answers, or could provide answers to the current philosophical problems, but that's what he argues. I think it's quite significant, because let's be realistic. If you look today, let's look at the modern Orthodox world, which is the only world that at least makes a claim to be involved in outside culture. You have, let's say, in Israel, you have Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, but look in America. Who really are the rabbinic leaders in the modern Orthodox world? You have Rosh Yeshiva YU, or Herschel Schechter, or Mordechai Willig, people like that. I don't think anyone can say that they have any involvement in wider intellectual concerns. Their involvement is in Talmud and Halacha. So this is not following the traditional modern Orthodox path. Maybe this is what we call centrist Orthodoxy, but this is not what Chazan is speaking about. Chazan wants rabbis who can respond to the intellectual challenges of the day. How to educate the children secularly. It's not just in Maimonides and Rav Sadia and the rest. You also have to give them good secular educations in the schools. Science and philosophy and everything. Chazan states that the teachers in for the Jewish children, Jewish schools, should be non-Jews, because they will not be able to influence the children to become non-religious, and in general, will have no interest in doing that. A Jewish child being taught by a non-Jew recognizes that we're from completely different worlds. However, if you have a non-religious Jew who comes in to teach math and science and all the other things, he could be a role model. A non-Jewish teacher is not going to be a role model for a Jewish student. He will be a role model, and the students could say, well, the teacher doesn't follow religion, why should I? That's very dangerous. Hirsch had the exact same approach. In Hirsch's school in Frankfurt, all the secular subjects were taught either by religious Jews or by non-Jews. He would not bring non-Jews in to teach secular studies. I don't know if any Jewish schools do that. I wonder, though, maybe the Satmar schools or, you know, the Mir, you know, they have a high school and thing. Maybe they have, although in America it would be illegal to officially do this, but I wonder if in some of the Haredi schools in the secular studies department, if they make an issue about hiring non-Jews to teach it. Certainly in the modern Orthodox schools, this isn't a concern at all. But that was Chazan's point. Chazan also was unique. Rav Reines felt exactly the opposite way. What did Rav Reines feel? That that non-religious teachers should teach the Jewish students? Wait till Yosef, we'll see what Yosef has to say here. We dealt with, of course, Rabbi Reines. We had a number of classes, but I didn't speak about that at all. That's interesting, Yisrael. You say the Hasid, Brooklyn says Hasidic schools only have non-Jews and religious Jews. The problem is that legally you can't do that. There was a guy who actually wrote a book called Teacher about his, I think that was what it was called, about his experiences teaching, working in a stop mark school. Oh, you're saying only religious Jewish teachers. The problem is that maybe that was a theory. I wonder if that was in practice. Because you often couldn't get religious teachers who knew a lot of these things. So faced with the choice, you went with the non-religious teachers. Obviously, Hirsch himself, if you could find religious teachers to do everything, that was the greatest Kiddush Hashem. Ezriel Hildesheimer, in his school in Eisenstadt in Hungary, before he came to Berlin and opened the rabbinical seminary, not only did he teach, obviously, Talmud and Halacha, he taught mathematics, and he taught, I think he taught Latin, he taught other secular subjects. That, for the German Orthodox, that's the greatest Kiddush Hashem, glorification of God's name, that the rabbis, in Hirsch's school, you had rabbis teaching science, and that to them was great. I will tell you that my school, JEC, one of the math teachers was Rabbi Lowy. Some of you might know him from Lakewood. He was a math teacher, and that was regarded as, I know Rabbi Teitz, who himself has a PhD in mathematics. He thought that that was a great Kiddush Hashem, but you can't always get religious teachers to teach a secular subjects. I would think in a Hasidic school, you would have, for secular subjects, they might dafka not want to have a religious Jew. They might only want to have non-Jews, because if you have a religious Jew who has a knowledge of science and all these other things, history, that might show a role model, might show the Hasidic students that, hey, you could be a religious Jew and actually go to college and actually have a degree in secular studies, and that would be dangerous. I would think, you can correct me if I'm wrong, Brooklyn, that a Hasidic school, they would, as we say, dafka, would want a non-Jewish teacher to teach the secular subjects to show that this is not something that Jews do. Chazan also showed his uniqueness in that he spoke about the importance of the land of Israel. Mid-19th century, who's speaking about the land of Israel? We saw about Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer in this Ashkenazic world, and here we have Yisrael Moshe Chazan in the Sephardic world. You also have Rabbi Yehuda Alkali, someone we'll deal with in future classes. And he actually contrasts the lack of concern among the Jews of Europe with the Sephardic Jews. So what is he talking about? Well, in the mid-19th century, you still had a big Sephardic community, relatively big in the land of Israel. They were actually living there, and they were working, whereas the Ashkenazi Jews were just being supported by charity. I think that's what he means when he speaks about the Sephardic Jews really taking the land of Israel more seriously than the Ashkenazi Jews. Okay, Neil, thank you for pointing that out. All this shows me is that there's no policy like there used to be. Chazan was a proto-Zionist. What do I mean by a proto-Zionist? He spoke about how Jews should buy property in the land of Israel so they should go on Aliyah. We already saw how Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer was saying the same things. These are unusual people who are ahead of their time by at least two generations, seeing what the future is. Many years before there was a Zionist movement, Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan tried to get the Jews in Europe to establish, listen to this, a Keren Kayemet Lekinyan Karkaot. A Keren Kayemet, a foundation to buy land in the land of Israel. Buy it from the Turks or whoever the landlords were. Faur speaks a good deal, as is his wont. He himself has an interest in this. He speaks a good deal about Chazan's criticism of the European Jews. For those who know a bit about Faur, you know that this is not just historical significance to him, it's also of existential significance. He's one of these Sephardic types who sees the Ashkenazic world as having destroyed Judaism in modern times, with certain exceptions. Obviously people like Shaul Lieberman and other important Ashkenazic figures he sees differently. And he himself is a student of Aaron Cutler. You should know that Jose Faur was one of the top students in Lakewood, so much so that when Aaron Cutler died, Faur was one of the people who carried the coffin. When Faur opened his yeshiva up in, I think it was 1958, in Brooklyn for the Syrian kids, Assyrian Boys, who was an advanced yeshiva, Rav Aaron Cutler came to speak there. So he comes from the inner circle of the early Lakewood people there. But as I said, he, if you've read his writings, you know that he doesn't have much tolerance for Ashkenazim. And I don't need to go into great detail, just in the interest of time, of Chazan's criticism. We spoke a bit about it. I don't want anyone to assume, who's listening, though, that Rav Yisrael Moshe Chazan was a halachic liberal. We've seen some liberal responsa, and there's more liberal responsa. I'll give you some more in a few minutes. But to show you that he's not a liberal, he was asked if it's permitted to shave on Chol HaMoed. Now, he's asked by people who shaved every day. In Italy, they shaved. They shaved in Italy going back a long time. The Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Lotzato, the great Ramchal, the one whom the Vilna Gaon saw as the most important Mekubal between him after the Ari, he was clean-shaven, as were the other Gedolim in Italy. In fact, in Italy, it was thought that, based on Kabbalistic reasons, you should be clean-shaven. And there's been a lot written about what was the Ramamipano clean-shaven. Apparently, Menachem Azariah Fano was not clean-shaven, but there is a tradition that he was. It turns out it's a false tradition. But the Chasam Sofer thought this was a true tradition, and he mentions this as a fact and discusses this idea that that in Italy they were clean-shaven. They were clean-shaven, just not Menachem Azariah. It's interesting that there's a Kabbalistic idea to be clean-shaven, because we usually think of the Kabbalistic idea precisely not to be clean-shaven. Chassidim, for example, they won't, I don't know about all Chassidim, Chabad and others, will not shave, will not cut their beards at all, not even trim their beards. But in Italy, great sages, it's a little off-putting sometimes. You see pictures of people you only know from their writings, their works, and you see them clean-shaven, and you try to imagine this is one of the great sages of Israel, a great Gadol B'Yisrael, and he doesn't exactly look the part because he doesn't have the beard, but that was Italy. They had these powders. Well, first of all, you can cut it very closely with scissors, and they had these I don't know how you pronounce it, depilatory powders. I'm assuming that's what they used. In the 19th century, they would have had that. In the days of the Ramchal, the non-Jews were clean-shaven. We have all sorts of paintings of them. We see, we're not talking about stubble here. I don't know, maybe someone can look it up on Wikipedia or something, when they had these depilatory powders, when they started, because we have all the paintings of people in Renaissance times. They're all clean-shaven, so they must have used something to take it off. I guess it's the 50s, when you have shavers, the halachic shavers, that's how yeshiva bachrim and religious people were clean-shaven. The problem with this is it smelled a lot, and if you used too much of it, it could burn your face off. But that's a good question. I will look into the history of these powders, which, by the way, you can still buy in CVS. I just saw them the other day. I don't know. Look in where they have the shaving stuff. I don't know who buys it, but maybe there's apparently some people who do. Good question. The history of shaving, of how people shaved. So, you'd think that in Italy, where they shave every day, and they cut their beards, they went beardless, that this would be a perfect example of how you can permit it during Chol HaMoed. You can cite the Noda B'Yehuda, you go back to Rabbeinu Tam, there's all sorts of ways. If you want to permit it, you can permit it. Just look at Rav Moshe Feinstein and others. Yeah, you're right. The non-Jews and non-religious Jews could use a sharp blade, but we have. Look in the Haggadahs and Pesach. You'll see the paintings, the old Haggadahs, and the Jews are clean-shaven also. There must be something. It's not a question of just cutting the beard so close, because then you still have a lot of stubble. They seem to be completely shaven. So I don't know. I'll try to look into that. So that's an example of a powder. There must be something. Believe me, there must be something on Wikipedia that describes the history of this, and I'll try to get to it next time. The rabbi who asked this question to Chazan thought that it should be permissible, and he even cites the tshuva, the response, which we just spoke about. Number one, where Rabbi Shlomo Moshe Chazan shows that he's so liberal that you could even use church music in shul. Certainly you can permit shaving during Chol HaMoed. But Chazan does not accept this logic. he says to the rabbi, that there's no problem using non-Jewish religious music in shul. That's why it's permitted. The only one who prohibited it, he says, is the Bach, Rav Joel Circus, the Bayit Chadash. And Chazan says about him, quote, he finds great joy in creating new prohibitions and limitations on the Jewish people. And we saw last week, this is Chazan's great criticism of the Ashkenazi Kapuskim, in that they rejoice, in his words, in creating new chumras, new stringencies. But not shaving goes back to the Talmud. The Talmud speaks about how you can't cut your hair during, and that includes the beard, during Chol HaMoed. So this isn't an example of a new prohibition. Now, Jews, to be sure, if they shaved, would be in line with the aesthetic standards of general society. But is that a reason? No. Chazan states, quote, if the values and aesthetic standards of the non-Jewish society come into conflict with our sacred Torah or the tradition of our sages, we will not give in on even the smallest matter. In his response, he raises this question, an interesting question. If we should be in accord with the proper standards of the world, the aesthetic standards, because in general we do. We dress the way the non-Jews dress. If something is considered improper, inappropriate, we don't do it either. So why shouldn't we pray bareheaded? After all, the non-Jews pray bareheaded. And he responds again, just like with the shaving, that the Torah tells us, we know from the Torah, that uncovered head is disrespectful. Now, when he says we know from the Torah, I'll show you in a minute why he says we know from the Torah. I think he probably means, though, we know in addition to this written law, we know from the whole Jewish tradition that praying with an uncovered head is disrespectful, because you don't actually have anything explicitly in the Torah telling you that a man has to cover his head. But he does point to the sota, the adulterous woman, that we uncover her head, and even if the words usually understood to mean uncover don't mean uncover, but dishevel, we still see that she has an uncovered head. The leper had an uncovered head. So based upon that, he says that we see that uncovered heads are inappropriate. The Torah tells us that. Obviously, the Talmud speaks about Jews cover their heads. There are certain passages that speak about proper behavior, although not a law per se, but proper behavior, and therefore the fact that non-Jews pray with uncovered heads, we don't change anything that's part of our tradition. And of course we can't go against the Torah. He cites the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch says in 91.3, Yeshomrim, there are those who say Asur lo tzi askara mipi b'rosh magula, that it's forbidden, let's say, to daven or say something holy with God's name with an uncovered head. And there are those who say Yeshomrim sheyesh limchot shelo ikanes b'beit hakneset b'gilui rosh, that you should protest, not let someone come into shul with an uncovered head. Now Chazan sees this as an example of the importance of an uncovered head. If I read this, I would see it actually the opposite. That here you see that it's not a law, and that there are those who say that you shouldn't have an uncovered head, and that if someone goes into shul, there are those who say you shouldn't let him in shul without an uncovered head. With an uncovered head, and we know that there is medieval authorities that speak about how Jews would have an uncovered head. Munda, we heard from Chaim Landerer before, Munda himself had an uncovered head. So I don't know, maybe Chazan is reading too much into that. So David, thank you for pointing this out, that the Tefillatories go back several millennia. Yes, it's true. The Taz says the prohibition of bareheadedness is because of Chukas HaGoyim. This is a famous Taz, but it's not generally accepted. The Vilna Gaon, certainly. Chazan cites the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon comments on the following. The Vilna Gaon he explains how there is no prohibition on going bareheaded. He's not the only one. The Marshal and others say the same thing. And the Vilna Gaon says that there's no prohibition on going bareheaded. Technical prohibition. Rav Avad Yosef has a response to them, and he concludes, halacha l'maisa, there's no prohibition going bareheaded. That's the halacha. It's just a minhag, it's a good practice. But today, it's become the general practice of Jews, so you should do it. However, he adds in something else. He says, it's not just that it's the minhag. Today, the non-religious, the heretics, they go without a head covering, therefore there's a special reason to go with a head covering. Now, I worked in Camp Hillel in Deal, which is a Syrian camp, and Rav Avad Yosef came there this summer. This was the summer of 1984, and the practice of the Syrians is not to wear a kippah. When he came to the camp, however, he told them that when they bench, they should, and when they eat in bench, they should wear the kippah. But other than that, these are religious people. They do not wear a kippah the rest of the day. This was the German practice as well. We spoke about it. And by the way, Chazan is very upset with the Vilna Gaon's position. He doesn't see it as correct. But the notion that it's not a commandment, a rabbinic commandment, and there's no obligation, is really derived from the Shulchan Aruch. This is the language of the Shulchan Aruch. You'll find this right at the beginning in Aruch Chaim number 2:6. Asur leilech bekomaz kufa. It's forbidden to walk haughty. V'lo yelech da'oramot begilui harosh. And don't walk 4 cubits with an uncovered head. Notice the difference in language. First he says it's forbidden to be in a haughty manner, and then he says, and don't walk 4 cubits. And everyone cites this as the proof that he doesn't regard it as a technical violation of halakha. And if you look in the Gemara, there's a sage who says in the Talmud that I should be given credit, I guess that's a good translation, because I don't walk 4 cubits with an uncovered head. Well, why is this anything special? Why is this being pointed out? Why does the sage get any credit for doing that? If it's an obligation for everyone, then of course you can't walk 4 cubits. The fact that it makes a special point of saying that he doesn't walk 4 cubits with his head uncovered is the biggest proof that it's not an actual obligation. And if anyone needs to see or wants to see the sources on it, you can see Rav Avadi Yosef's responsum in Yechav Adat, where he cites them all. And then, just to have full disclosure, though, since we dealt with Rav Mesas, I should say that Rav Mesas disagrees, though. He sees the Shulchan Aruch speaking here, Lav Dafka, not exactly. And he says, if you look in the Beit Yosef, you see that despite the other Rishonim's position, who did hold that it wasn't an obligation, the Shulchan Aruch actually holds that it is an obligation to cover your head. It's a big dispute between Rav Shalom Mesas and Rav Avadia Yosef on this very point. And he points out that the Darchei Moshe, Rav Moshe Israelis, it understood the Beit Yosef as saying that it's an obligation. Reuven Bonfil, I've mentioned the name Reuven Bonfil in the past, Robert Bonfil. He's written some wonderful books. He's the expert on Jews in Italy. He's written books on rabbis in Renaissance Italy. I think 2 books on Jews in Renaissance Italy. He's professor emeritus at the Hebrew University, Italian Jewish history. But before that, he was a Rav in Milan, Italy. And then he came on Aliyah. He became the personal secretary to Chief Rabbi Nissim. That's the context in which we mentioned him. But he also has an article, a very interesting article, on changes in religious practice of the Jews of Rome during the 5 years that Yisrael Moshe Chazan was there, 1847 to 1852. And let me tell you about some of these very interesting changes that Yisrael Moshe Chazan instituted. He was the chief rabbi of Rome. There was a case that came before him where one of the new settlers outside the ghetto walls died. It was right before Yisrael Moshe Chazan. During his time, Jews begin to settle outside the walls of the ghetto. The Pope permitted Jews to settle out there. So you had a shiva minyan, obviously, at the house, and people from the ghetto were sent to make a minyan at the house. However, it appeared to Chazan, at least, and he obviously was informed about certain things, that this was making too much of a scene. The Pope had given permission for Jews to live outside the ghetto walls, and it was important for Jews to keep a low profile. To have every day, twice a day, group of Jews, it could have been 20, 30, who knows how many Jews coming, marching through the new section where Jews had only recently been permitted to live, to come to someone's house, that, Rishon Moshe Chazan thought, would reflect negatively on Jews. It could lead to a backlash. It was very important for Jews to get out of the ghetto. It was overcrowded. It was unsanitary. And therefore, it was dangerous to have all the non-Jews. They could make an issue that the Jews are creating trouble. So, Rishon Moshe Chazan declared that the mourners in the shul, the mourners in the house outside the ghetto, should come to shul. We don't do this, of course, unless there's no choice. But we send the daveners to the house of the mourner. The mourner's not supposed to leave the house. Rav Yisrael Moshe Chazan paskin that the mourner should come to shul. It was that important for both davenings, mourning and then mincha ma'ira. This is number 11 in his tshuvot. Now, This wasn't just a tshuva for those people living outside the ghetto walls. He issued this as a tshuva for all Jews in Rome. And from that point on, it was the practice, and perhaps it still is the practice, that mourners do not have a minyan at the house, they go to shul. Von Fields tells us that this was also the practice in other cities in Italy, although he doesn't know whether this came from Rome. I'd imagine it would. Why would in Trieste, for example, or Venice, they start a practice of mourners coming to daven and shul instead of going to daven at the house? I'm assuming Chazan started this practice, and then the rest of Italy thought it was a good practice, and they began to follow it as well. This was still the practice in Rome in 1971 when von Fields wrote his article. Whether it is today, I don't know. I would think it probably is not, and at least not completely in Rome. Those Italian Jews who follow the old practice, would still be following this. But look, Chabad comes to town. Chabad opens up a shul. You think Chabad cares about a takana of 150 years established by the great Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan? No, Chabad opens their own shul. They do their own minhagim. They don't care. And obviously, Chabad will have Bali Tshuva, Italian Bali Tshuva. These people are going to follow whatever Chabad says. I'm not just saying that Chabad's wrong necessarily. If it depends how small the community is, if there's not one community, but Chabad obviously is known for adopting Chabad practices, so much so that today, as we speak, in the courtyard in Vilna, the Vilna Gaon's courtyard, where the Kois was, and where the Cheirim on the Hasidim was declared by the Vilna Gaon, right now in that shul, they daven Nusachari. Chabad have taken over. I knew about this. I mean, I always thought this was a strange thing, but about 10 years ago, Rav Aryeh Leib Baron, he's still alive, although I don't know how well he is, from Montreal. He probably was the greatest Rav for many years in Montreal, the second greatest Rav after Rav Hirschsprung in Montreal, an alumnus of the Baranovich Yeshiva, great Talmud Chacham. They led a tour. He led one of these tours of Eastern Europe. And this is what my friend told me, who's a student of Aryeh Leib Baron. When they came into Vilna in the shul, the very place where the Chassidim were put in Cheirim, and Rav Aryeh Leib Baron saw that they were davening there, the sitter in the pews was Nusachari. He stood up in front and he started screaming. He couldn't control himself. That not only, remember the Book of Esther, they've actually come into the palace and taken over the queen itself. I saw it myself when I went to Havana, Cuba. The shul there, the Sidurim are all Nusachari. There was no Chabad in Havana years ago, but the Chabad comes in about 15 years ago, and they bring in all their Sidurim. So I'm thinking, if someone can check it out in Italy, I am certain that in the Chabad shuls, they do like we do, that they make a minyan at the house. There was another practice, or rather practices in Rome, that Chazan stopped. Now, what I'm going to tell you now is going to seem very strange. That's only because it's foreign to our lifestyle. I'm going to describe to you exactly the sort of thing that people who don't know the history of Judaism, when they see something like this in another religion, will speak with great pride about how Judaism is opposed to such practices. They'll see the Shiite Muslims on their, one of their holy days, they give each other lashes. And I've heard Jews say, "Oh, that's so barbaric," that sort of thing. It turns out, however, that pretty much everything you find in other religions, you can find parallels in Judaism. I have to say, it's often the Kiruv people who are the worst offenders in this regard. I wrote a bit about this on the Sfarim blog. The example I gave was the issue of marriage, divorce. There's a dispute in the Talmud between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. Beit Hillel, that we hold, says you divorce anyone who wants to get divorced, you can get divorced. Beit Shammai's position was really akin to the Catholic position, that divorce is not permitted unless there's unchastity on the part of the woman. That's actually not the Catholic position. The Catholic position is you can't have divorce at all, but in the New Testament there's two versions of what Jesus says. One is that no divorce, and the other is that you can't have divorce for unchastity. So it's one thing to say that the Jewish position on divorce, in which we allow it for all sorts of reasons, is much more realistic, it's in line with the way people live, that's fine. However, sometimes these people go overboard, and they start talking about how any other position is foolish. They end up degrading Beit Shammai's position. And I don't think you can degrade a position. We don't accept Beit Shammai, but to speak about any other position. Like they'll say, anyone who says that the only time you get divorced is if there's adultery, that's foolish, that's idiotic. It shows that people are not, these other religions are not in line with that people change and the Torah position. What do you mean the Torah position? There is no Torah position. There's a position of Beit Shammai and a position of Beit Hillel. We passing like Beit Hillel. Some people say in the time of Mashiach will hold like Beit Shammai. The Moroccan Rabbanim held that Beit Hillel's position only applied in the second marriage. But in the first marriage, we actually hold like Beit Shammai. At the end of the day, it's a machlokas of our authority, so obviously we hold like one position, and there's nothing wrong with explaining why one position works better, but to go so far that you end up degrading Beit Shammai, make him seem like an idiot, because his position is just so foolish. That's the worst degradation in the Bizayon Torah I can imagine. And I found often that these people, they try describing the quote, the Jewish position, and why it makes so much sense, and in doing so, it's not just enough to say how good their position is. They feel that the only way they can build up their position is by putting another position down, and often it's the case that the position they're putting down is actually held by one of our great sages. We don't hold by it, but it happens to be in a Jewish position as well. I sometimes pointed this out to these people, and then immediately they're all upset, and they say, oh, I won't do this again, I won't do it again. They were doing it 2 minutes ago. 2 minutes ago, they thought it was a stupid position. Now when I tell them a great rabbi holds it, all of a sudden it's no longer a stupid position. It just shows, I think, how simplistic it is. Well, we will get to that. I see it's already 10 o'clock. We'll begin next class with some of the strange Kabbalistic practices Jews in Italy were doing and why Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan felt that these had to be abolished. The idea, for example, when Jews died, they were given the Dalet Mitot. Dead people were given skila and srefa and lashes. They weren't literally burnt, obviously, just hot wax put on them. And they weren't lashed with heavy whips, just with light whips. I'll describe the sort of thing that if you tell people today, they would say that, and you wouldn't tell them it's Judaism. When I was living in Scranton, I read a passage to someone out of one of the Achronim, to one of my neighbors, and he thought, as I said, it was the craziest thing. But then I told him who said it, all of a sudden he has respect for it. Some of these things that people today will say are absolutely off the wall have a strong Kabbalistic traditions and were practiced not only by the sages. The simple Jews, the people who Chazan calls Pshutim, they too wanted to do that. And if it appears strange to us, well, of course it's strange. But this is very much a part of the Jewish tradition, and we'll have to see, though, why the Mashiach, Yisrael Moshe Chazan, felt that he had to get rid of them. So we'll end here. Let me just, we'll take some questions. I'll respond to some of this. I want to remind all of you, we are having December 24th, Christmas Eve, Nitto. I'm giving a special talk, also 9 to 10, on the strange practice of Jews not studying Torah Christmas Eve. Even if you've read my article on the topic, there'll be some new stuff in it, and obviously the tangents that, from the emails I get, I become famous for. Let me look at some of the questions here. Of course, well, Sefer Hasidim, obviously. But I'm talking about, I'm not saying these are un-Jewish things necessarily. And what does it mean, un-Jewish? I'm going to quote Sefer Hasidim next class. If the non-Jews are doing something that the Jews feel is positive and is a good thing, and we assimilate it into our practices, is it un-Jewish then? Or have we made it Jewish? We've converted it to Judaism. Its origins could be non-Jewish, but lots of things' origins are non-Jewish. But what's the problem with that? We already mentioned last class, Tov Sheba Goyim, you know, the good things among the Goyim, we adopt. Rav Avram ben Arambam thought that prostration was a great thing, and this was the original Jewish way of doing it. The Jews stopped doing it, and therefore we have to then adopt what the Muslims are doing, because they hold the true tradition, and we're going to adopt it from them, although this was originally something that we used to do. It's not just in Havardi's journals, Dovi. He wrote a lot in Hadarom and maybe Or HaMizrach, and he has many, many Sfarim. Nominal. I think you meant, when did I use the word nominal? You mean antinomianism? Well, missionizing. Jews have not missionized. I'm not sure what you mean, Barak. Jews have not missionized, at least in Second Temple days. If you look in Second Temple days, we know that Jews did try to missionize. Herod, his grandfather was one of the people converted by force, but there was also missionizing. The New Testament mentions Jews going out to proselytize. It's strange why we don't proselytize. Why not try to bring Torah to people? But we don't, for whatever reason. The Zohar Akiah says converting someone is a mitzvah, so that would lead you to want to convert people. But the fact is, we don't. So I'm not sure when you say they missionize. Jews have not missionized, and they still don't missionize. So ShapiroM2@scranton.edu. Oh, of course, Jews don't do. Yeah. Menachem Mendel is correct. Anyone who took Dr. Berger's class, let's say at YU, he gave the whole class on Hasidei Ashkenaz. Some of the stuff there is very strange. But you don't need to go to Hasidei Ashkenaz. I mentioned last class Navardic, Chaim Grada, the story he told about the not putting tefillin on. In Navardic, they used to confess their sins. Public confessions of sins. That doesn't strike most people as a Jewish thing. And look, we can have lists and lists of all these things that, as I said, anything that appears to be a good idea from any perspective, that any practice that you can find some good justification for, I can almost guarantee you that someone in traditional Judaism has done it at one time and thought it was a very good idea. No, I think you're referring to antinomianism. Antinomianism is the idea that one doesn't need to follow the law to find salvation. It's enough, one can avoid the strictures of the law. You can find grace just in belief in God and, let's say, the moral law. That's the great Christian heresy, that you don't need the law. It's enough just to practice ethics and things like that. But antinomianism means violation of law for a higher purpose that you can reach where you need to go through the higher purpose. Shabtai Tzvi. They changed the bracha of davening. So it's no longer matir asurim, release the prisoners. It was matir isurim. And to permit the sins. And they knew of certain traditional text that spoke about how messianic days, certain prohibitions would be waived. So there's antinomianism expressed with regard to the messianic era. That's why the Vilna Gaon and his followers were so upset with Hasidism, because where would it lead to? If you're going to tell me that you're not going to start davening until you're ready to daven, well, maybe you're not going to celebrate Pesach until June. That's when you're ready. And there was a great fear that they would go off the path. The Makor Baruch, Baruch Epstein claims, I don't believe him, but he claims that in conversation with the Aruch HaShulchan, that's his father, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, acknowledged that if it wasn't for the Vilna Gaon, Hasidus would have gone off in the direction of antinomianism. When we get to Rav Tzadok, we will see some examples of antinomianism, of the idea of Avera Lishma, of for some people, you don't need to follow the rules. The Hasidim, the only example of antinomianism I think they have is that the times of davening, they feel that they can move beyond the times, that they don't need to follow them. But that's what antinomianism is, and it's a struggle in not just in Judaism, in other religions, that's in Sufism, for example, in Islam. Certain people believe they get so close to God that the laws no longer apply to them. And I mentioned already the Rambam. He points out that Shlomo HaMelech was guilty of antinomianism. Shlomo thought that he knew the reasons for the prohibition on not having too many wives and too many horses, and therefore he felt it didn't apply to him, because it only applies to the average people, but for the elites like him, that they knew the reasons, therefore they can violate the prohibition, and it's okay, because they know the reasons. And the lesson of this, as the Rambam says, is that Shlomo HaMelech violated the prohibition, and he was led into idolatry. So antinomianism is a very dangerous thing, but as we saw, there are antinomian traditions, even in mainstream Orthodox Judaism, certain Hasidic texts, Tzadok and others. There are even people, at least one major sage, who claim that if you have never sinned, and it's before Yom Kippur, you should actually sin. Why? Because tshuva is one of the mitzvos, 613 mitzvos. And the only way you can follow all the mitzvos, do tshuva, is to sin. And then he says, well, the Gemara says you can't say I'll sin and then I'll repent. But if you look in the Gemara, what does the Gemara say? It says you can't say echte ashuv, echte ashuv. Or is it echte, echte ashuv? I think it's echte ashuv, echte ashuv. That is, you can't sin twice. That you can't do. But if you've never sinned, I mean, who's never sinned? But at least in theory, if someone never sinned, You should do one sin on purpose so that you can do tshuva. Sound strange? Sound crazy? This is actually has nothing to do with Sabbateanism. It has nothing to do with Hasidism. This is just, I don't know, this is just a strange idea. What can I tell you? Oh, nominal charge for the shia. Okay, I didn't even look. There's a $10 charge for the Christmas shia. $10 is $10 Canadian. So I don't know what that is. $7. Basically, all these you get for free. And if you miss one and you want to get it online, they're 99 cents Canadian. So we're asking that people to try to help us out here, try to help Torah in Motion, that for this special talk to put out the $10. I'll try to guarantee that it'll be worth your while, that you'll hear things you won't hear anyone else. But at least if we can get a good number of people on it, they can help out. And I'll repeat, for those of you, if you can donate money to Torah in Motion, that's great, but there's a better way to do it. Look on some of the old MP3s. You can find lots of great stuff. You can purchase them, download them, and it helps run the site. Okay, I'm sorry I didn't bother looking at the thing, but at least I still think what I said was maybe valuable and interesting. And Yisrael, don't remember that for next Yom Kippur, but I'll try to get back to it. We'll stay on for 2 more minutes. Does anyone else have any questions? I don't know how common it is, but it's mentioned by the Rashba and it's mentioned by the Rush as a punishment that in Spain they had the authority given them by the government to punish people, physical punishments, kill people also if they wanted to, and they would punish people in this way. If you look in Yitzhak Baer's book on the Jews of Christian Spain, this gets back to what Menachem Mendel said a few minutes ago, he is only too happy to point out that these practices of torture, cutting people's tongues off and all that were taken from the Christians. And I have no doubt that he's right, that these practices were taken from general jurisprudence. But that's you can find it in English in Yitzhak Baer's book on the history of Jews and Christians in Spain. Yeah, I'm going to, next class, we'll probably start with the Ridvaz, Rav Yaakov Wolofsky, and I'll speak about the Brisker Derech and a little bit of Ashkenazic and Sephardic Talmud studies. So save that question for next class. We'll talk about the tradition, because we're going to deal with the Ridvaz's attacks on the Brisker method, so we have to know what is the Brisker method, and the irony, because the Rambam's approach, does it really fit with the Brisker method? What was the Ridvaz saying? So we'll get back to Sephardic and Ashkenazic approaches to Talmud study next class. Hopefully next class. Well, Ba'ur's position is that look at the Sephardic world. The Sephardic world is Sephardic students today do not have access. They don't model themselves after people like Rav Uziel and Rav Yisrael Moshe Chazan. They become Ashkenazified, not just in dress, but in outlook. You have Haredi Sephardim. There was never a Haredi Sephardic world before, so that's one thing Fa'ur is speaking about. He also thinks that the traditional approach, I'll mention this next class, is the tradition of the Gaonim through the Rambam, through the Sephardic authorities, and that the Ashkenazim, with the Brisker method and the Chakiras and all that, they've destroyed traditional Torah study. Traditional Torah study is supposed to be the focus on halacha, not just theoretical Torah study. We'll get back to all this stuff, because really the Ridvaz and Fa'ur would like the Ridvaz. I'll talk about all this next class when we deal with the criticism of Ashkenazic Yeshiva Torah study. No, it doesn't mean it literally. It's a pun. Chadash means the new grains. So he comes up with this great pun that Chadash Asim in the Torah, anything new is forbidden. That is, if the reformers come up with something, I don't need to show you halachically why it's improper. It's improper simply because it's new. We don't do things that are new. We follow the tradition of the past. So it's not literal. And he didn't follow it himself 100%. He permitted certain things that were new. But he used the pun when he liked it. That's all it is. It's a pun. Rav Yosef Spinmar, to a certain extent, not completely, Fa'ur would say, but he's trying. Rav Yosef is trying. By the way, there's another reason why Fa'ur is so upset about the Ashkenazi world, because it was really the Ashkenazi world, it was the Sephardim who were Ashkenazified that pushed him out of the Syrian community. Fa'ur was a completely religious Jew in all respects, and is to this day. Huge Talmud Chacham. He was teaching at the Jewish Theological Seminary. He was given a heter to do this by Rabbi Matsu Babadi, who was, although not the chief rabbi of the Sephardic community, one of the great rabbis in the Syrian community. And with the Ashkenazification, or the Haredification, of the Syrian community, this became untenable. So much so that they turned to Rav Shach to have him basically put under Cherem, Rav Moshe Feinstein as a tshuva, and it became difficult for the Syrians community, even the ones who were more liberal, to keep Fa'ur on. So Fa'ur basically was declared a heretic for doing something that he was given permission from his teacher of Matsu Babadi, and that led to a lot of ill feeling, as you can imagine, from him to the Ashkenazic figures. He told me a great story how he brought Rav Matsu Babadi, the author of the Magen Ba'adi, he brought him to the seminary to speak to Lieberman. And he said, if you've never seen, Matsu Babadi and Shaul Lieberman engage in Torah discussions, you don't know what it is to see two Gedolim engage in Torah scholarship. So that's Fa'ur. Fa'ur is obviously, and I'm not going to deny, he's written things which are improper. He has an article called Anti-Maimonidean Demons, where basically he treats certain Rishonim as if they're just crazy people, and people with axes to grind, and people with all sorts of evil motivations. I don't think we can write about Rishonim that way. But that's very recently. Up to the articles in recent years, you saw his animus against the Ashkenazi world, against maybe the Rush and people like that, but it wasn't expressed as openly as in the last few years. Yes, you can get all of his stuff. Brilliant person. Okay, well, Mark, and we will... We'll see why he says Ashkenazim don't know how to study Talmud. Because if you want to know how to study Talmud, you need to know how the Gaonim studied it, because the Gaonim are the successors. And therefore, that goes. And if you want to know how the Rambam studied it, you have to understand the Gaonim. And you have to go through the tradition. You can't just take the Rambam and set him up as some sort of Ashkenazic Rosh Yeshiva and start working on him. You need to know the whole tradition. That's his point. We'll get back to it next class when we deal with the Ridbaz. Okay, well, with that, I'll just wait 30 more seconds if anyone has anything else. Thank you very much for your comments. I received more questions. I'll try to get to some of them next class. There's still things I want to get to, though, from the previous semester, stuff you'll find really fascinating. Good. Okay, we'll end tonight then, and we'll pick up next week. Everyone have a good week, please.